John Palmer joins me this week to discuss pale ales, IPAs, and water. This is Beersmith Podcast number 284.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 284, and it's early July 2023. John Palmer joins me this week to discuss pale ales, IPAs, and water profiles. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also Beersmith Web, the online version of Beersmith Brewing Software. Beersmith for the Web lets you design great beer recipes from any browser, including your tablet or phone. Edit recipes on the go with access to tens of thousands of recipes, as well as the full suite of recipe building tools. Try Beersmith for the Web today by creating a free account at beersmithrecipes.com. And finally, a reminder to click that like and subscribe button on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever platform you're listening on. Clicking those buttons is a great way to support the show. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back John Palmer. John is the author of the top-selling homebrew book, How to Brew, as well as definitive book on brewing, water. Today, he joins us to talk about IPAs, pale ales, and water. John, it's great to have you back on the show. How are you doing?
Thanks very much. Yeah, it's great to be here. Doing great. Doing great.
Awesome. It's been 9 months, I think, since we last had you on the show. What have you been working on lately? I think you mentioned a new book a minute ago.
Yeah, I've written a book called How to Brew in Your Kitchen, and it focuses on 2.5 gallon or 10 liter batches, brew in a bag, no sparge on the kitchen stove. Smaller intro book to help people get into the hobby.
That's really
and
cool.
And it's going to be published in Spanish. Yeah.
In Spanish. Did you write it all in Spanish?
No. They're going to have to go through the trouble of translating it. But I'm also working on the next edition of How to Brew.
Are you
and
really?
That'll take another couple of years.
I was going to say, is that going to be 1,000 pages? The last one was pretty hefty.
Yeah. No, we're trying to streamline that. We're trying to slim it down a bit.
Okay.
It may be time to safely lose a couple of the appendices and, like on building your own gear and stuff. We've kind of moved away from that, I think. I got to work on that next year or so.
That's awesome. And if I recall, you were editing a few things as well, right?
Oh, yeah. I'm in my job for the editing for the Master Brewers Association. There's always another book there to work on, and we got some good ones coming out from the MBAA later this fall.
That's cool. Well, great. Today you wanted to talk about pale ales, IPAs, and how water drives the flavor of beer. And you picked a couple different styles, so let's start with the first one, which is British bitters. So can you talk a little about, about the overall flavor profile and sort of the style, what it looked like?
Yeah, when you and I were talking last week about, different water adjustments for different beer styles, mm-hmm. It kind of got me on this track of, the evolution of American pale ale and American IPA and hazy IPA. And I think it may help people wrap their head around water adjustment to take these seemingly different styles and seemingly different waters and help draw the dots, draw the lines between the dots on how similar they really are.
Mm-hmm.
A little context helps round it out. So yeah, if we start with British bitters, British pale ales, In a word to describe British bitters, moderation, I think, is the best descriptor. They have moderate maltiness, moderate bitterness, moderate hoppiness, hop character, and it all comes together in a very extremely drinkable composition. Everything in moderation, nothing biting each other, just a very sublime drinkability.
At the same time, there's some complexity there too, I think, in terms of,
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot more off flavors, for example, in a British bitter than, maybe a continental ale.
Yeah. You can't have complexity without balance. And, British beers are superbly balanced, nice balance between the malt and hops. So you can taste the different aspects of maltiness, the touch of toast, the touch of caramel, and the bread from the malt, and as well as your hop character. You've got a very well balanced bitterness that is riding side by side with maltiness, and in addition to that, you have a little bit of hop aroma and flavor from the dry hop they often do. So, yeah, just with balance comes complexity. The bitterness units to gravity units ratio of these beers is about 0.75 or, 3/4. Mm-hmm. That is, the bitterness is about 3/4 of the points that the gravity is. So look at, there's three grades of British bitter, light, medium, and higher, or large, I guess you'd say. Anywhere from 35 up to 1035 up to 1060, I think, where it goes. And so your bitterness at any gravity would be about 3/4 of that. And so it is a more assertive hop character in a British bitter than you would get, say, in a typical ale or a typical lager, Kolsch, Helles, other ales, golden ale.
Continental styles and so on.
Yeah, various kinds of stuff. Typically, you're looking at a gravity, a bitterness to gravity ratio of about 1/2 for those styles. Half the bitterness of the original gravity. So British bitter coming in a little bit higher at around 3/4 makes that hop character more assertive. If you look at American craft brewing and home brewing, you can see where we took that concept of a hoppy British bitter and turned it up to 11. As Americans, everything has to be more. So we added more hops, and we brought that hop character, the BU to GU, up to about 0.85. Another little boost in bitterness, another little boost in dry hop character. And it made the malt to hop balance become a little bit more hop forward. Mm-hmm. Same gravities. And for a while there, we were doing the same thing with the malt bill as well. We were adding more caramel. We were adding more Munich. And this really was birth of the American amber ale style. Mm-hmm. When you start adding more caramel, adding more maltiness, and changing it from amber up to say copper color, increasing the sweetness, now you need more hops to balance it. Thus, that evolved into American amber.
And then the other thing I find interesting is, of course, they changed the yeast, right? So a lot of the complexity you get from the British yeast, maybe not so present in the American version.
Exactly right. Yeah. Switched to American yeast, American hop character. And it became a uniquely American style, readily differentiable in tasting.
Stepping back for a second, though, what does the water profile look like? Because that's one of the things you want to focus on for the original bitters.
Okay, so we're looking towards London for the British bitters, and I'm sure you know, every region of England has their own bitter style that goes back hundreds of years. But the water around London is high, moderate hardness or medium hardness and high alkalinity, meaning that the residual alkalinity was a positive value. I think it's about 0.75, 0.85, something like, or 75 or 85 residual alkalinity, which means that you need more dark malts in the grain bill to balance that alkalinity in the mash to get good yield. Keep in mind that when these beer styles are being developed, pH wouldn't be invented till 1920 or something like that. So, yeah, they were figuring it out purely from an extract and yield point of view. And the water, the London water, also had a balanced sulfate to chloride ratio, kind of 1-to-1. Not terribly assertive, both of the numbers around 50 ppm, 40 to 50 ppm. So just right under just that threshold. The practice of Burtonization, this is kind of interesting. Burton, the beers of Burton were recognized as being special, unique. During this, even during the 1600s, probably by 1650, definitely by 1700, there were people writing about the unique beers of the Burton-on-Trent region. And the Burton-on-Trent region had much higher hardness water, higher than London, calcium sulfate. Yeah, than higher than London. Burton-on-Trent, for here, those of us here in the States, it's about 120 miles north of London. So it's, you know, it's not really close to London. And one misconception among American homebrewers was that Burton Ale was an IPA, and that's not really the case. A Burton Ale was a big, you know, 1060 kind of gravity, but a sweeter beer. Didn't have the depth of hop character that an IPA does. Now, they had bitter stock ales, the ales that they would store for a period of time, and that they did add hops to. And those beers were the ones that became the IPAs of the day. And IPAs were being shipped to India and elsewhere in the empire early to mid 1700s on. So it was just kind of a gradual replacement of Burton Ale with the bitter stock ale, as you know, which was the most popular beer in the region. And then that they even though they didn't have the concept of pH at the time, they had the chemistry that let them understand that the water of Burton-on-Trent is what allowed this clarity in their ales and Burton ales, and that technology lent the same appearance to their stock ale. It led to a higher sulfate character, referred to as Burton Snatch. A little bit of the sulfur coming out in the aroma of the beer, and so. Burtonization as a science and an improvement to brewing water was known, and by roughly 1850, that concept, that science, was also made known in Europe. And I was talking to Professor Ludwig Narsis a few years ago. And he commented that when they developed the Pilsen beers, they employed Burtonization of their water to brew a brighter, clearer Pilsen beer in Pilsen.
And of course, the sulfate driving it up changes a lot of things, right? What else does it change?
Yeah, the sulfate dries out the character, you know, the overall malt character of the beer, makes that beer more crisp. It accentuates the hop character, making it more assertive, yet fading faster on the palate.
You mentioned age clarity, yeah.
Yeah, age clarity. The higher, the Burton water is both high hardness and high sulfur, basically high in gypsum. And so the higher calcium, it really aids beer clarity. And it has a profound effect on yeast flocculation, trub formation, et cetera. So you just naturally get a much clearer beer in a high hardness, high calcium water than say the London water, which had medium hardness and high alkalinity.
So that obviously changed things quite a bit for pale ales. Like I'm thinking of the classic Bass pale ale, for example.
Right.
Now let's go and maybe switch gears back to American pale ale, which came, along with American amber, were developed sort of in the early craft beer days. Can you talk a little bit about those styles and how those compare to their English counterparts?
Sure. So, as homebrewers and you and I were in the thick thing, 30 years ago, discovering all this stuff for the first time, we were enamored of the tales of Burton on Trent and brewing these hoppy, crisp, Bass ales and Burton ales and IPAs and so on. So I remember when I first wrote how to brew, in the late 90s. It's funny, I remember how much of an aside my IPA recipe was at that time. It was, in your first edition of How to Brew, it was Victory in Chaos, British IPA. No American IPA, just the British IPA, there it is. And it was just like something to include. It wasn't the main styles that were being brewed back then, being pale ale, porter and stout, or amber and stout. But we were enamored with more hops, more calcium sulfate, and so we saw all these suggestions to add calcium sulfate to all of our recipes back then, which made that hop character more assertive, and like you said, with the addition of American yeast and American hop. Hop varieties led to, American pale ale. Well, that same mindset, we took British IPA and brought it into the fold, added American yeast, American hop character, higher hardness, and the high sulfate that we thought was the key to brewing these styles. And that led to the development of American IPA. Or West Coast IPA, as it's kind of referred to today. Mm-hmm. Less emphasis on the malt side, although many of the IPAs back then were quite, amber colored. I mean, they were, anywhere from 8, 10, 12 SRM, whereas now they're more firmly in, say, the 5, 3, 5, 7 kind of range for today. Mm-hmm. They're paler. But yeah, we took, the higher strength of the English IPA, going from roughly 1060, now kind of bumping that up to 1070, and I embraced that, kicked it up even to 1075, added more hops, more assertive character, and with American IPA, we were approaching a 1-to-1 bitterness unit to gravity unit ratio. Again, making that hop character even more hop forward. The balance of the beer more hop forward than American pale ale.
Mm-hmm. Did you? How did the water profiles evolve over this time? You mentioned that in England, obviously we had the London water, which had mm-hmm. a certain profile, and we had the Burton on Trent water, which had a certain profile. And I know in the early days, we didn't necessarily play a lot with water profiles, except a lot of us were adding gypsum, I think, at that point.
Yeah.
But how did the water profiles for the styles change as we Americanized them?
Well, and that's kind of hard to define, because you're right. For a long time, we really didn't understand. I, for example, did not understand how water profiles worked. I felt that, you know, yeah, we needed to increase hardness and we needed to adjust the alkalinity somehow. But all of that was kind of at least a little bit intangible. And A.J. DeLange and others, Martin, for example, helped us codify that and helped me understand it. And that's how I wrote the water book. But what we basically did was I said, okay, we're trying to emulate this Burton on Trent water to make great IPAs, to get this crisp hop character. Then we started understanding, okay, that 800 ppm sulfate was not a real value. I mean, yes, it was the real value of the groundwater if you dig down in Burton-on-Trent and analyze that, but you have to realize this is what comes out. Read Mitch Steele's IPA book, one of Ron Pattinson's works, or Martin Cornell's works. You realize that they were brewing from wells that were drilled halfway between the brewery and the river. And the river, of course, had much lower hardness, much lower alkalinity, calcium sulfate. So they were really brewing with a blend of the soft river water and this hard groundwater. So let's just say that we'll cut those sulfate numbers in half, you know, to say 400 max.
Which is still very, very high. Yeah.
Yeah, still quite high. And it definitely contributed to the character and mystique these beers had. And so in trying to emulate that, we were also doing higher and higher calcium sulfate additions. As we came to understand how those calcium sulfate additions affected pH, mash, and understood where we wanted to be in the mash for good conversion, we started, you know, kind of moderating all of these guidelines and kind of bringing them down to more realistic numbers. So, yeah, we were brewing very high hardness, high sulfate IPAs for quite a while. And then we've kind of since dialed it back to much more palatable numbers, also numbers that don't leave quite as much calcium carbonate scale in the hot liquor tanks and mash tun.
Yeah. I remember, using a lot of gypsum, particularly back in the day. I did have a question, though. Going back to we talked about bitter and we talked about the Burton on Trent styles. A traditional British IPA, do you have any historical sources to have any idea what the water may have looked like or perhaps where they were made?
Well, they were being brewed in several areas. The Burton region, and forgive me, I'm not the beer historian that other people are.
That's okay.
I think one of the popular breweries there, Hull, or anyway, yeah, they were brewing with the Burton water, the higher calcium, higher sulfate water, and then they're also being brewed elsewhere with, you know,
much kind softer of mimicking water,
that
I assume,
same, yeah. with softer water, but still highly hop, still basically a stock ale, an ale that would be, you know, fermented, dry hopped in the barrel, and then those barrels left to sit for a year before they would be consumed. And so the original IPA probably was had a certain amount of Brett character to it.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, Orval may be the last surviving traditional, you know, or real IPA out there in terms of its hop character and Brett character for a stock ale. As you know, but as we move forward in time, you know, the Brett character went away, and so now, and then at the same time, you know, in the 20th century, hop prices, malt prices, the wars, you know, beer gravities have come down, refrigeration happened so that they didn't need the high hop character, the high bitterness to travel well. And I could go off on a tangent to American adjunct lager and the origins of that. From the late 1850 on, up into early 1900s, less bitter beers were extremely popular, and you know people wanted American lager. It was clear, it didn't form chill haze, it didn't spoil, you know, didn't get infected as much. It was a much more flavor stable product, and it was less bitter. People like that. So yeah, the popularity of heavy bitter stock ales really plummeted in the latter half of the 19th century to the 20th century.
Makes sense. Yeah. And also I think, you know, there's a lot of local options available too, coming out the market at various places. So we didn't necessarily have to ship it across the world. So walking through the different styles, so let's talk a little bit about some of the modern styles. So like an amber or a original pale ale, and I'm using, sort of like a traditional American pale ale, maybe something like a Sierra Nevada. I assume they didn't do a lot of water adjustment at that point, right? Because we didn't have a lot of this knowledge at that point when a lot of these beers were made.
Right. Yeah. They were adding calcium salts and... The water up in Chico, for example, is a moderate hardness, kind of balanced profile, if I remember correctly. You know, in the 50 to 75 ppm range for calcium or for sulfate and chloride. But it, you know, is a more balanced profile. The addition of calcium sulfate would help bring out that hop character a bit more. But it really was a fairly medium level water, moderate level water, not super high hardness, not super high sulfate. And it provided a good balance between the malt and hop characters. And the same went for amber ale, pretty much brewed at the same water. And in many breweries across the United States, especially some of the eastern breweries, they're being brewed with surface water, so they were soft water sources.
Right.
So yeah, kind of low mineral, and made the beers overall softer, as opposed to the American IPA.
And then as we move had it, that, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh no, I was just saying. I was just going to finish with saying that we had that ideal of Burton, you know, for the IPA style.
Makes sense. Yeah. And then as we move forward into, we see the American IPA style start to come on the market, I guess in the, mid aughts or something like that. Right.
Yeah.
Did we have, I assume we still didn't have a lot of water knowledge then, but we were probably still kind of following along with kind of the Burtonization approach or what?
Yeah. It was, that was very much the era of the classic brewing cities, you know, profiles.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, people were doing water adjustments based on matching these classic brewing cities. Again, not really tying it and there's, you know, tying those additions to their source water and mash pH. pH was, you know, known, and we would talk about, you know, 5.4, 5.2 pH. That we would see in brewing, in like German brewing textbooks and some of the other, you know, malting brewing science textbooks out there. So yeah, I mean, it was coming together. It was coming together.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you published the water book, and about that time, I started to hear people get a little bit more serious about their water, and of course, I'm sure it affected the commercial IPA brewing as well.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, even still today, when I do my occasional consulting job on water, just especially for contract breweries, they will be given a recipe and told, here is what you do. Here are all the salts that you put in and all the malts that you use and hops and so on. And they brew it with no regard to what their source water already has in it versus the original source water.
Which is a big problem.
There's still that disconnect. But, you know, it's getting better. We were drilling down to, you know, exactly how much adjustment was needed. I remember, back in the early or late 90s, early 2000s, there was talk of kettle pH being more important than mash pH for a good beer. Mm. You know, wrong, you know, a little bit wrong, not totally wrong, but a little bit wrong. But, you know, it comes from the idea that if you have the mash pH right, to get the optimum conversion and yield from malts, then that chemistry, that well-coordinated chemistry is going to continue on through the brewing process. And so, yeah, if you have the right mash pH, it's going to mean you have the right wort pH going into the kettle, and that after the boil, that pH is going to be very favorable for fermentation as well. So it's, it wasn't completely wrong, but it was just slightly wrong emphasis and not understanding the way it flowed down. I feel like I'm getting off track again.
No, you're good. You're good. I wanted to bring one more style into the mix, which of course is the hazy New England IPA, which is kind of a unique beast from a water perspective.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about the style, how it differs from the other IPAs? And then of course we want to dive into the water profile for that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great topic too. So American IPA, it had its growth spurt in the early aughts. By 2010, you know, they had been around. We had done red IPAs, brown IPAs, black IPAs, white IPAs. We had done every IPA we could think of.
Well, and not to downplay it, but they still make up over half the craft beer made in the United States. So it's still a substantial thing. But go ahead.
Silver were widely popular, but, you know, there's like, where is this going next? Well, late hopping, more hops. More hops is always a passion for American homebrewers and craft brewers. And, of course, they found that by adding them later in the process, you preserve more oil. Get more oil and more aroma into that beer. Mm-hmm. And in the Northeast, this led to, you know, somebody, it might have been Trillium, it might have been Treehouse or one of the others, all late hop additions, no hops in the boil. And the beer turned out hazy. But, you know, it also had massive hop aroma and a massive hop flavor. And it had a kind of a juicy character to it. You know, they were realizing more hop character doing that method with a hazier IPA versus the crystal clear standard of West Coast IPA, you know, Green Flash, Stone, Russian River, et cetera. And Firestone, those were all crystal clear West Coast IPAs. And there, now we have this hazy Northeast IPA. With you know, better, deeper hop aroma. And that was the birth of the hazy style. Now, in experimenting with that, they, you know, added some more wheat, more oats to the style, helped increase the head retention, made it fluffier tasting. And when you start looking into how to enhance that that juicy, fruity character, you've got to look at pH.
Mm-hmm.
And so, one downside to lots of dry hopping or whirlpool hopping without boiling is that your hops raise the pH of the wort and the pH of the beer. And I think, I don't have the number in front of me, it's like, I think 1 pound per barrel raises the pH like 0.4, almost one half, unit.
Substantial,
so,
yeah.
Yeah, so as you add more and more hops, late, whirlpool hopping, dry hopping, the beer pH starts rising considerably. It can become, the beer can become coarser tasting, more astringent, more coating, to your palate. And so we are still adding the same amount of calcium salt, but we're adding more calcium chloride because that accentuates maltiness and backs off a bit on the assertiveness of the hop character, makes it softer and makes the beer balance a little bit maltier and sweeter and less aggressive.
Probably the extra sweetness complements the fruity flavors too from the hops, I would think.
It really does. And that's an aspect of the juiciness character that people were looking for that made the beer more approachable to the public than previous IPAs have been. But the other aspect to juiciness and fruitiness is acidity. Because as you know, if you bite into an orange or an apple or other piece of fruit, those are fairly acidic items. And so a lot of brewers these days do acid adjustments post-fermentation to bring that pH back down. During dry hopping, beer pH can rise up to 5.6.
Wow.
Back up to almost mash level from the 4.6 it was. I guess 5.6 is kind of extreme, but it can rise a lot. And so they would do acid additions to bring that back down to the 4.2, 4.4 range, which is more typical of a pale beer.
Hmm. Interesting. So they're actually, I assume, adding some kind of acid post-brewing, I guess.
Yeah. Typically phosphoric. You can also use lactic or a combination thereof. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the water profile then is almost the opposite of what you have for an IPA in a lot of ways, right?
Right. Well, it's the same. It's the same in terms of calcium and alkalinity. You want hardness. You don't want alkalinity. You want a negative residual alkalinity to help bring that mash pH down, to your target 5.2 to 5.6 of room temperature. But to do that, you've got to, you're also brewing a paler beer, so yeah, you're often adding additional acid to that high hardness to help that high hardness along. It's hard without the specialty malts that add acidity. It's hard to get pH down with malts alone.
Hmm.
So they're usually adding some acid to the hot liquor tank or to the mash tun to help get the initial pH down. But they're swapping out the calcium salt. Whereas before we were using calcium sulfate to really accentuate the hop character, make it dry, more assertive, more aggressive. Now they're switching to calcium chloride. Calcium chloride accentuates malt character, makes the beer taste a little bit sweeter, makes that hop character a little softer, and overall the focus of the beer switches from an aggressively bitter beer to a huge, soft, hoppy beer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, appreciate that distinction.
Yeah. So we're getting to the end, but I was wondering if we could walk back through the different styles that we talked about today, maybe starting with the bitter and then the Burton on Trent and so on, and just describe the water profiles for each, so it can help homebrewers maybe target each of them.
Yeah. So, yeah, British bitter, you're looking for a balanced sulfate to chloride ratio. 1-to-1 or near 1-to-1, somewhere in the 50 to 75 ppm range for both sulfate and chloride. You're looking for moderate hardness. Again, 50 to 75 calcium is a good number. You're going to typically have medium to high alkalinity. That could be 75 to 100 ppm of bicarbonate or total alkalinity. Your residual alkalinity is typically going to be positive, somewhere in the 50 to 100 range. Mm-hmm. And you're going to rely on especially malts that you're adding to these British bitters to help bring that pH down back into that 5.2 to 5.6 range. So again, medium hardness, medium to high alkalinity, but you're putting up with that. It's not a goal. It is. And then medium sulfate chloride, 50 to 75.
And then switching to a Burton ale, for example, different?
Burton, Burton ale. Now we're moving, from London up to Burton. And now we have higher hardness, 75 to 125 calcium, and anywhere from 400 to 500 sulfate, typically, in the diluted water they're getting with the river. Hard to know exactly, but... different breweries did different things. You're generally higher hardness, higher sulfate, and you get a much more hop-assertive beer.
And then, of course, switching over to the United States, let's talk about the early amber and pale ales. What kind of a profile would they have?
Yep. We're imitating that same kind of profile, but with softer, typically softer water, surface waters in the eastern half of the country. Again, adding some calcium sulfate, generally looking at the same kind of levels as British bitter, 75 to 100 calcium.
So pretty moderate water, not the Burton on Trent then, right?
Right, right. 50 to 75 calcium, or sorry, sulfate. 50 to 75 chloride, sodium, and would be whatever. When you go to American IPA, except for that, now we crank up the calcium sulfate, we make more additions, and we're taking that calcium level to 100, 150 range, high range. Again, the same with the sulfate, anywhere from 100, 150, up to 300 in some cases, in the 2010s.
Which, of course, is going to accentuate the hoppiness in the beer, right?
Exactly, yeah. And then with the advent of hazy IPAs and the evolution of those, we flip the sulfate and chloride around. Still high calcium, and maybe that comes down a little bit, more around the 100 ppm max. But we're taking that chloride up to 150 ppm with, say, only 50 to 75 ppm sulfate.
So, I mean, when we look at the sulfate to chloride ratio, which is sort of the ratio of bitterness, is it almost inverted there from a regular IPA, basically?
Yes.
Wow. So that's cool.
Whereas the sulfate to chloride in the West Coast IPA would be something like 2-to-1 or 4-to-1, the sulfate to chloride in a hazy IPA would be 1-to-2 or 1-to-3.
So almost inverted, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, cool. John, I was wondering maybe if you could just close with the overall role water plays in a lot of the modern beer styles, and also maybe some comments on where you see us going from here.
Yeah. I think I try to keep this in perspective. Water is an important aspect of brewing. It is that final 10% of the flavor profile, if you will. Being able to adjust the sulfate and chloride and the hardness to alkalinity to really dial in the right pH for the beer and the right flavor balance, sulfate to chloride, hoppiness to maltiness. Where you put that balance is that final adjustment to make to a great beer, just like, you know, final seasoning a great chef does to a dish. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, you can brew good beer, any water out there, any clean water source out there. It's when you understand the nuances of seasoning and fine-tuning pH that can allow you to really open it up to the next level.
Awesome, John. Well, thank you again for coming on the show. Really appreciate you being here.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, it's a great pleasure today to have my good friend John Palmer. John is the author of the top-selling homebrew book in the world still, which is called How to Brew, as well as the definitive book on brewing called Water. John, thank you again for coming on the show.
Thank you, Brad.
A big thank you to John Palmer for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also Beersmith Web, the online version of Beersmith Brewing Software. Beersmith for the Web lets you design great beer recipes from any browser, including your tablet or your phone. Edit recipes on the go with access to tens of thousands of recipes, as well as the full suite of recipe building tools. Try Beersmith Web today by creating a free account at beersmithrecipes.com. Again, that's beersmithrecipes.com. And finally, a reminder to click that like and subscribe button on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever platform you're listening on. Clicking those buttons is a great way to support the show. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.